Book 1. Revelation. Colchis. 118 years ago, Terran standard. 24.5 years ago, Colchisian calendar. Translator's note on time. The world of Colchis is of a magnitude larger than Holy Terra, and consequently even approximations of time by the accepted nomenclature of Terran Standard are unsuccessful in conveying the very different diurnal and nocturnal cycle of its inhabitants. Before we begin, the reader should familiarize themselves with the following information. The orbit of Colchis around its star takes nearly 5 years, 4.8 to be more precise. Therefore, if a Colchisian refers to being 6 years old, they are in fact 28, or 29 Terran years old. A Colchisian solar day, that is, one complete planetary rotation, is 7.1 Terran days, or 170.4 Terran hours. Clearly, even humans, as adaptable as they are, cannot survive with a 90-hour day-night cycle. And so Colchisian culture developed a system for intermediary sleep and waking periods. These periods are often referred to as days in many volumes, but this can be confusing and portray an erroneous image of events. In this text, I have endeavoured to achieve a more literal translation of the Colchisian terminology, which is derived from the language of the ancient desert settlers. Day, in the following manuscript, refers to a complete orbital turn of the planet from sunrise to sunrise. This day is further divided into the following times of approximately 24 hours each. The exact length depends further upon seasons and locality, and chronometry on Colchis is a dedicated and difficult scientific discipline in its own right. Dawn away, morn day, long noon, post noon, dusk eve, cold fall, high night. These sub-days are then broken down into three further periods, two of wakefulness and one of sleep, approximating 8 hours each. These three periods are called wake-rise, wake-main, and rest-eve, with the last being the sleep period, although frequently inhabitants may sleep less than 8 hours during morn-day, long-noon, and post-noon, and slightly longer during the darkness of the remaining time. One might therefore refer to wake-rise of dawn-away being sometime in the first 8 hours of the first 24-hour period of a new Colchisian day. Custom has it that the hottest time, wake-main of long noon, is also a rest period. For when the local star is at its zenith, it is exceptionally deleterious to health to be out of cover. Conversely, rest-eve of high night is the coldest and darkest period of the Colchisian day. As for other such timekeeping measures, such as months, local year counts, and so forth, I have spared the reader all but the most scant detail, for such things are exceptionally complex and not necessary for understanding this text. Chapter 1. 111. Sands the colour of rust. Ash and old sweat stretched out to the haze-blurred horizon. Even in the baking heat, some life clung on. Scrubs of thorny bushes and trees, cacti and brightly flowered succulents rose in the shadows of pillar-like rocks, sustained within the meandering wadi and drawing sustenance from the deep remains of lost oases. There was movement everywhere, if one knew where to look. Scorpions and sun beetles skittered over the scorching sands, and flies buzzed lazily from cactus to cactus. Far above, in the wisps of cloud that scudded across a pale blue sky, immense sand vultures with 4 meter wingspans circled in the cool upper airs, eyes as powerful as magnoculars scanning the ground for any morsel. Dust devils skirted across the dunes, erasing the tracks around the camp, piling fresh drifts against the sides of 13 large tents made of fabric striped red and blue, black and gold, grey and white. Sunshades held up on strong poles shielded against the unrelenting long noon blaze, keeping the worst from the backs of prized bipedal sunstrider mounts and much more heavily set sternback sled beasts. Their short hair stained red by the dust. The animals panted in the heat despite the shade, eyes closed against the glare coming off the nearby dunes. More huge parasols were set up on the leeward side of the camp, and beneath them clustered the declined. Old and young, they huddled about their solar stoves, cooking patties made from grey cactus flour, flavoured with treasured drops of honey spider milk. They talked quietly and nursed their canteens, perilously low now that they were 2.5 days out from the last oasis, debating the best course to take at wake-rise of dusk eve, when the dropping temperatures made travel practical again. They fingered talismans and fetishes of small bird and mammal bones, intricately carved with verses passed down from ancient generations. The eldest dozed, clasping prayer sticks across their chests, the faint whistles and whines from the pierced bones changing as their chests rose and fell in the constant but weak breeze. Around them, infants dug in the sand for wadi nappers and desert whelks, though in their minds they imagined they were opening up one of the lost vaults to unearth archaeotech treasures from the time of the last wandering. They picked over pebbles and small fossils, dividing them into piles of varying shininess, size, and other criteria only small children would understand. The older children dared each other to stand in the sun for as long as possible, timing their efforts with small sand glasses, ignoring the warnings of their parents who spoke of some uncle or aunt who had died from a skin-curdling sun rash or been consumed by swarms of tumours. The youngest adults attended to the shrine. The centre of the camp was dominated by 4 large poles, each made up of separate totems carved in the many likenesses of the 4 powers. Though they were declined, forbidden entry into any of the great cities, they nevertheless paid homage to the gods of their ancestors as best they could. Offerings of small sacrifices burned in incense bowls at the base of each pole, their scented wisps drifting out across the camp, carrying the prayers of the faithful into the air. The ward priests kept the small fires burning, moving from one to the next in constant work, wafting air, rearranging kindling, adding sprinkles of more incense where required. Now and then one of the nomads would rouse in the stupefying heat, struck by a sudden thought or need. They would scribble their prayer on a scrap of papyrus and pass it to one of the totem attendees. Murmured incantations would accompany the flare of burning papyrus, their meaning lost to antiquity, but their importance sustained over 100 generations. 112. Fan Morgai, leader of the tribe, gathered his family to a brief council. He pointed to the darker shimmer on the horizon, which a stranger to the deserts might have mistaken for a mountain. The nomads knew better. The mound, whose peak was just visible in the distance, was no natural formation, but the remains of a city of their ancestors, long dead sands claimed by the desert.
2 more rest eaves for good walking, he told them,
waving the fabric map that was his most prized heirloom. The symbols were all but faded from view, but he knew how to read the topography, taught by his mother and grandfather as soon as he was old enough to learn his letters.
A prayer in a hole, muttered Stanzia, his eldest sister. You think the gods will guide us to a lost vault?
No, Fan Morgai said with a sad shake of the head.
I think that this is the city of mirrors. See the clouds above it? Rain, my boys and girls. Rain, soon. The wadi at Fushas is said to be flooded again, said his youngest cousin, Fabri Tal. Only a wake rises walk away, no more.
The wrong way,
argued Cora, Fabri Tal's elder brother, who had already expressed his favour for the plan of Fan Morgai.
And who said this? A drunken soothsayer at Maiporis. He would tell you anything for a sip of jacass.
He had one of the old books, protested Fabri Tal, and he cast the bones upon its pages right in front of me. I saw a wind symbol and the sun. Fresh beginnings, he told me.
And you spared him a sip of your liquor for the good news, said Fan Morgai.
He was about to continue, but a shrill call drew all their attention to the shaded watchpost on stilts erected at the windward side of the camp. Others were standing, shielding their eyes against the glare.
Go, Alanat. Swap with Benjo,
Than Morgai told his young sister, and she dashed off into the light, sweeping her headscarf about her face to shield against the sun for the moments it took her to reach the watchpost. Benjor dropped down and ran back to the elder, his looking tube glinting in his hands. He gestured for Than Morgai to meet him between the two nearest tents, and pointed into the wind, a little to Edgewood's.
Caravan!
He blurted, thrusting the seeing device to Than Morgai.
Caravan!
The tribal leader lifted the telescope to his eye. Retinal detectors clicked and whirred as they adjusted the liquid lens, bringing the horizon into sharper focus. He swept right a little, towards the far distant coast, and caught a blur of darkness against the dunes, no more than a kilometre away.
Caravan. Out here.
He looked at Stanzia, and they shared a glance of concern. They both looked to the main tent that housed the chief's family.
Say nothing to the strangers,
she told him, and he agreed with a nod.
Make ready. Get your weapons,
he told the others.
But do nothing to provoke them, and let me do the talking.
113. The largest vehicle crested a broad dune like a breaching whale, its huge flanks rearing up over the sands amid a plume of dust and smoke. A dozen small funnels trailed oily fumes from their gargoyle caps. Thick wooden tracks churned the sand as it achieved the summit, the sand plough upon its front furrowing aside dirt and grit into twin banks on either side. Details were scant, the caravan just a vague darkness in the haze. But as the vehicle approached, the other shapes around it resolved into better focus. Two crew four-wheelers ran as outriders, their roofs and spoilers glinting with solar collecting plates, balloon tires carrying them over the shifting desert. With them came actual riders, mounted on sunstriders, decked in faded ribbons and pennants, the streamer of a black and red prayer flag curling from the back of each scout. Their faces were hidden by thick scarves and glare goggles, their riding robes tattered and dirty. Their steeds had also seen better days, flanks scarred by sandstorms, hair matted, tails docked short in the style of the inner waste tribes. Other vehicles followed, forming an entourage for the temple rig, carts pulled by threesomes of dromedors and sunstrider chariots, two of them, each hauling chains and weighted flags through the sand to obscure the trail left by the caravan. The shrine wagon could now be seen more clearly, a turret above its driver's cab topped by numerous flared speakers flanking a pulpit, large reflectors casting a brightness onto the decking behind, where dozens of armed men and women waited. As the great sheet above the deck flapped and bulged in the winds, spear tips and mauls, arrows and sling staves glinted in occasional flashes of sunshine. Beyond the stacks of the traction engine, the large wagon heaped up into a type of aft castle, upon which two spear launchers were mounted. Here, mast-like poles were joined to the exhaust piles by black and red bunting, missing in places, giving the impression of gap-toothed grins. From the summit glinted a golden icon of a book aflame, a symbol of allegiance and faith, a testament to one of the proselytizing creeds of the old cities, the Covenant of Varadesh. 114. The glimmer of eyepieces sparkled along the deck of the shrine wagon as the occupants turned their attention to the cluster of tents sighted in the distance. Orders were barked down the speaker tubes, and the engines of the mobile chapel grumbled in response to the coaxing and curses of the crew below, hauling the unyielding vehicle onto a new course into the broad sand basin beyond the ridge. Nairo darted between the caravan guards, scooping a ladle from his bucket to slop grease onto the exposed cogs of the running gear below the main platform. Around him, the sellswords at the gunwales readied their windbows and dart guns, and loosened cudgels in their belts. A few aimed kicks at the aging slave, others directed only curses at the man, winding his way in a half-crouch between them. He was clad only in a loincloth and headband, his whip-marked back and shoulders an exposed maze of sun-darkened skin and white scar tissue, turned leathery and cracked by years of exposure. It was, powers be praised, a miracle Nairo had not been cursed with the tumours like so many of those he had grown up with. His advanced age was something of a talisman among the other slaves. 6 Colchisian years he had survived. 30, as the Adepts of Terror would later reckon such a time span. His head was shaved bald, tattooed on the right side with a simple version of the Book of the Word, symbol of the Covenant who ostensibly owned him. He passed fierce Catholic mercenaries, their porcelain masks flat over their faces, decorated with cruel visages drawn from the vision journeys of intoxicant-fueled coming-of-age rituals. They wielded serrated spears, their jerkins adorned with discs of refractive material that gleamed white in the high sun. Next to them, the archer brethren, sea warriors, now confined to land, their wind bows resting on the side of the wagon. Fierce of expression, the men heavily bearded, the women with braids tied under their chins in imitation of the favoured facial hair. Witch walkers of Karthas, dispossessed by the loss of their homes, swallowed by the great earth tumults of a year earlier. An entire great city disappeared into the sand and waters, destroyed, so it was claimed, by the Covenant for their sinful ways. This handful of survivors caked their bodies in ochre paint out of shame, its colour visible between their segmented plastrons, vambraces and greaves. And more, from other cities, and none, all of them converts. Not a single warrior was a native of the Covenant. None were born of Varadesh, the holy city. This simple fact made them more fervent followers, with the vigour of those whose existence now depended upon the truth of the word to give their lives meaning. Their adopted creed made them as zealous as their master. Of him, of the bearer of the word, there was no sign. The warning had been sent to the caravan's master that a declined camp had been sighted. Nairo cast glances at the hatchway that led to the master's chambers in the bowels of the temple rig, but there was no movement to be seen.
115. Castora, the herald slave, scuttled into view from the smaller entrance further aft and quickly ascended the ladder to the pulpit as the mobile shrine ground to a halt 100 meters from the outskirts of the camp. With a scratch and amplified crackle, the address system sprang into life at her instigation. Movement stirred in the camp as the nomads assembled at the edge of the shade cast by their covers. Nairo could see the glint of weapons, spears for the most part, nothing advanced, but the arrangement of the decline suggested curiosity more than hostility. They could be seen talking to each other, casual in their attitude. An automated clarion wailed several distorted notes from the prayer hailers, cutting through the rasping wind.
"Rejoice, those who have fallen from the gaze of the powers," announced Castora.
She spoke water words, the common language of the traders and missionaries who moved between cities. Nairo could see her face, resigned to her task, though she tried her best to summon as much enthusiasm as she could for the audience.
"Celebrate the beneficence of the powers. For this day they have guided to you the bearer of the word. Fear not, for he brings only counsel and wisdom for those who wish to heed it. No longer must you dwell in the wilderness of ignorance. The bearer of the word shall set you back upon the path to the truth, and through his indulgences you shall know again the will of the powers."
The sound of a foot upon the steps drew Nairo's eye back to the open grate. As Castora continued her speech, lauding the benefits of the truth and the righteousness of the bearer of the word, the master emerged. He was young, 3.5 years by the measure of Colchis's long orbit, but his brow already carried the deep furrows that would permanently twist them in later life. Gaunt he was, but not yet possessed of the lines of care and age that would mark his older years. He was garbed in dirty tatters of dark grey robes, marked by sigils of the powers and designs of the constellations of the Empyrean above, the very same clothes that had been literally ripped from his back when he had been cast out of Varadesh. His flesh was thin, his existence in the desolation honing his body to wiry muscle and little else. Already his skin was marked with the scars of exposure, dark from the sun and scratched from the wind-borne sands. Castora withdrew as he reached the bottom of the pulpit ladder, slipping over the edge like a fleeing serpent to allow the master to ascend without obstruction. With characteristic energy, he hauled himself up to the addressing platform, while the clarions sounded their greeting call again.
"Heed the bearer of the word,"
he declared, raising his arms above his head.
"Witness the truth from my lips, and remember the name of Kor Pharaon."